Hello and welcome to Compulsive Reader Talks. I'm Magdalena Ball, and today's guest, Marina Kameniev, is the former deputy arts editor of Moscow Times and has been widely published in The Atlantic, Time, Sunday Life, The Monthly, Marie Claire, often writing about family. She lives in Sydney and is the mother of two and the author of a fantastic book, which shortly will be released, called Kin, Family in the 21st Century. Marina, welcome.
Thank you.
So good to have you on the show. So
Thanks for having me.
before we begin talking, can I just ask you to please open the show, as we always do, with a little bit of a reading from Kin, just to give people a sense of the book?
So this is the introduction, so literally page one, and it's introduction, the portrait of a family. Here's an exercise. Take a piece of paper, grab a pen, pencil, crayon, any drawing utensil within reach. Now, draw a typical family. I'm confident, regardless of your drawing skills, that there are likely to be two big people flanked by two smaller people on your page. One of the bigger people has a circular head perched on a triangle with limbs protruding from either side. Beside mother is father, plain and Spartan. The two children are smaller versions of their progenitors. If I had to make a wager, I would bet that the typical family you have in mind, the one you've drawn, is a nuclear one, a heterosexual couple and their children. Not because this configuration happens to represent the members of my household, but because the paradigm of the traditional family has remained imprinted in our collective subconscious decades since its heyday. The Western nuclear family was established as a trope in the 1950s when it became both prevalent and aspirational. During this time, this kinship unit was greater than its members. It stood for conservative values and a booming post-war economy. The parents had predestined gender roles. A husband in command of important decisions such as finances, a wife presiding over all things domestic and unpaid. They share the same facade as Mad Men's Don and Betty Draper. Unlike in the show, the social mores at the time meant that any private discontent remained hidden from public view. Joan Didion described this wholesome period with its cars, appliances, and women in high-heeled pumps and ruffled aprons removing cookie sheets from ovens as a reward for the losses of World War II.
Great, wonderful, thank you. Firstly, I really love the book, and it's such a unique concept. I read your interview with Tammy Sussman. I think you put it up yesterday, but it's quite a recent interview. Yeah, and I agree with Tammy and you and what you said, that for those of us who fit neatly into the stereotype, that stick figure, it just feels innate. It feels almost like that is what we mean when we talk about family. But I was listening to the Ezra Klein show last week, and he had this amazing episode, right? Did you hear that, where he interviews relationship experts, Raina Cohen, about the shrinking of our families and how that's a relatively recent experiment? Like that we take this for granted, but that the whole notion of what a family is really began, as you beautifully contextualize it, relatively recent, and it's continued that trajectory of shrinking.
That's right. And it's, I mean, that's a wonderful episode. And you spoke again with Dan Savage about it as well. I'm desperate to read that book, but it is. It's about how socially the nuclear family kind of also it became the norm. It became a template. And it wasn't working. Like it wasn't a great system. And especially when the economic climate changed and you had to have two people to work full time to support a family. And during COVID, this became really clear that it wasn't enough. You need the village, you need the community. But equally, when you look at the hierarchy of this nuclear family, it's much higher above all other relationships. And that's what he spoke about with Raina Cohen, because there's all these other wonderful, beautiful relationships that don't have a label on them and don't kind of aren't as easily understood and absorbed into society.
Yeah, that's right. It kind of, again, for somebody who fit quite neatly, and I know not everybody does, and your book, really beautifully contextualizes that too. You really talk about the different ways in which families are made, and not necessarily kind of the stereotypical one that I guess my grandparents thought of as the dream, right? Which is this kind of suburban heterosexual two family you know, three kids, whatever, two kids, but just a kind of, you know, a neat little universe that kind of fits the norm. But really, this notion of the different kinds of families and you know, these different ways in which those families are constructed and built over time, and even, you know, even those friendship families, these you know, new families of people who are supportive of you, that aren't necessarily your blood.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And I think there is a lot of that. There's, you know, I definitely have friends that are more than friends, and not in a sexual way, but they definitely do kind of
they pick up the
I've
slack.
tested, yeah, but also I've tested the unconditional love part. They still love me. And I do think they sit in another category that isn't quite recognized. I mean, and that's just friendship. And you know, even one of the things with my family is my dad, I grew up an only child. My dad has kids that are similar age to my kids. And it's a really funny kind of relationship. But people ask, oh, are you sort of like an auntie? And I guess I am, because we don't have other ways to sort of, you know, help explain that relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you called these multi-parented group families, and you know, also thinking about migration too, and the fact that you're, you know, one's support networks may be in another country, and you know, we are a civilization on the move, and it's only going to get worse, right, as different parts of the world become uninhabitable. But I think you called them guilds, these extended families or multi-parented group families.
So I think it was Luke. I haven't said his name out loud ever. I think it was Luke Gahan, but I need to fact check that. So that was his particular term for it, guild families, as multi-parent families, as platonic parenting. I mean, people try and give all kinds of names to them, but still legally they don't hold. And I guess what I found really interesting in Luke's, I think it was Luke's study, was this. It's not so much the way that families come together, it's also the way that they come apart. Because I remember there were sort of there were two couples parenting, and sort of a biological, it was a same-sex female couple and a same-sex male couple. And the female couple broke up, and because one partner, the non-biological mother, was much older, she kind of got relegated to a grandparenting role. That's what she wasn't commenting on that. She wasn't interviewed for the study, but it's really interesting as well, because, you know, if my husband and I divorce, we're still the parents. We will always be the parents of the child. But, you know, with these families that kind of sit outside of that, you can create them, but when they come apart, it's very hard to keep those relationships intact.
Yeah. And that's one of the, I guess the, let's call it beautiful complexities that your book explores and goes into some detail about, you know, how do we deal with, you know, what is effectively a kind of handshake arrangement in a legal sense when those, you know, those things dissolve. And what I really like about the book, and what's really interesting, is that you take very much, I think, throughout the book, a child-centric view. So, you know, who is impacted by this, and what is the impact of that? And how does that, you know, when you think about the kids and these relationships, you know, even if you just think of a straight divorce, as from a child's perspective, it's often not looked at. You don't think about it. It's you know, it's common. Everybody gets divorced these days. But, you know, what is the impact of even that on a child? And then to look at all of these permeations is very interesting.
It is. And they're new. And it's hard. You know, you kind of, I'm not an academic. So you do read a study. And equally, I didn't want to interview anyone for the book who didn't want to be interviewed. I did an adoption chapter, which I ended up not using, but it was very distressing to hear people upset and knowing that I made them upset. And I think I really had to have a good reason to kind of, you know, trigger that emotion. And so I don't feel like I could just interview someone, leave them upset, and write a little blurb about them. I really wanted to interview people who were ready to and happy to talk. So, and why I'm saying this is I'm not getting like a cross section. I'm not getting people who are unaffected by the way they were conceived. I'm not, you know, I'm getting a very kind of specific audience, and that's fine. But also what was interesting, so, you know, there's Susan Golombok, and she's one of the first people to study these kinds of families, and she's still studying them now. And essentially, they do good. They do the same as other families, but telling children earlier if they're donor conceived, that kind of helps. And, you know, yeah, having those honest conversations kind of helps. And having, you know, access to the identity of the donor, that's kind of something that could be useful. But when I spoke, like, there's an exception to every rule is what I'm trying to say. And also people feel different things at different times. Like the people I know who have donor conceived kids, their kids don't care at the moment who, like, that's not, like, one of them I know has turned 18 and is able to meet the, or identify her father, her biological father, and she has no interest in it. But, you know, it changes. It often changes when you have children and you look at your child. And I certainly felt for a second much more interested, especially after my first child was born, and you're looking at the baby and you're like, who does she look like? And I got baby photos out, and my baby photos are from the Soviet Union. They're black and white. They're not like, I look like I was born in the 1920s if you looked at my photos and compared them. But it was, you know, I don't really do that now, and it was just a brief period, but I can understand why that would trigger you to want to know. So, you know, aside from the studies, I also think it's a moving space. People feel differently at different points in their lives about their identity.
Yeah, and that whole chain of who you're connected to and what does that mean? You know, even if things like inherited trauma, you know, what have I inherited? Trauma or not, you know, even what genetic
disease is.
And all of that, I think, comes later as you get older and you're starting to face, you know, what is my future going to hold and what am I carrying?
My
genes. So yeah, just fascinating stuff. But how did you go from, I know you wrote an absolutely brilliant piece of writing, which I think a lot of it is in the book already, it's like 2019 in the monthly, called The Sperm Drought, right? And I think was that the origins of the book? Did you just feel like you'd scratched the surface of something and there was much more, or how did it all come together?
That was the impetus for the book, but I'd been following the space much earlier than that article. So I think it was around 2012. And I think I found the original study that I printed. It takes a lot for me to actually print something because I don't have a good relationship with the printer. So if I have something on paper, it means I've fought for it. Around 2010, 2012, there was an inquiry going on in Victoria. And they were talking about changing the sperm donor laws. And already sperm donors weren't allowed to be anonymous across Australia. But what Victoria wanted to do was to retroactively change anonymous sperm donations so that the men who had donated in the 70s and the 80s were no longer anonymous. So they signed on the basis that they would be anonymous. And, you know, here they were now, probably with grandkids, about to kind of have their identity revealed. And I didn't read it very deeply, but I thought, well, gosh, that's a bit unfair. And, you know, even as a journalist, you sort of value confidentiality. If someone says, don't, you know, can I use a pseudonym? I would use a pseudonym. And I'd be horrified if, like, someone went through my work and got the real names of everyone who I interviewed. So I really, I felt it was unfair. And at the same time, one of the donor conceived people, Narelle Grech, who'd been speaking for years about her plight to find her biological father, she was in the news because she got diagnosed with stage 3 bowel cancer, and she was just 30 years old, and it wasn't on her mother's side. And also because she'd been collecting all these little, you know, breadcrumbs of who her biological father was, she knew that there was something like 8 half siblings that, you know, would have maybe had this gene. And it just suddenly felt like my mind just changed. And I don't know if you are, you know, having these conversations about Israel or Palestine or vaccination or Donald Trump, but often, you know, I'll go to my dad's house and I'll sort of give him a lecture about something. He'll give me a lecture about something. We walk away angry and nothing's changed. But when your mind kind of changes that quickly, I just found it very, very interesting. And so I kept following the space, which led to the sperm drought, but I kind of kept following, you know, all sorts of aspects of it, like including, you know, DNA testing, because now whether you're anonymous or not doesn't really matter, because you can do, I've got it on my desk, the ancestry DNA test, got it for my birthday. You know, you can do one of these and, you know, cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, and you, again, you go into that. So I guess that's it's a moving target, right? But technology is always changing what is and what isn't possible. And, you know, what's right and what's wrong. And, there are other philosophical debates you lean into too. And I love that you don't come onto one side or the other, but, you know, like a good journalist, you provide, you know, just the information. But, you know, another one that I thought was really quite interesting is the notion of helping concept of helping families,
the altruistic
people to start families, the altruistic side, versus the commodification. And, you know, it's really tricky, isn't it? Because, you know, you don't want, they're just a lot, it's a minefield. And again, you go into a lot of that in the book, but it's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's fascinating with surrogacy, because I mean, I kind of often think about if I needed a surrogate, and people are very against commercial surrogacy, and I understand exactly why. But, you know, if you take all the sort of moral stuff aside, I would feel much more comfortable, you know, to pass a paycheck and shake hands than to kind of say, okay, you're going to be, you know, this family member. Or because when someone is doing it altruistically, they're still doing it for a reason. And it's a deed that you can't give back. You will not be able to give birth to their child. Maybe you'll donate a kidney in 10 years time. I don't know. But like, there's no sort of bigger gesture.
Anybody who's carried a child, right? Not a small thing to do for somebody, my God. And who knows, right, what hormones are going to do in terms of that pregnancy and what you want, what kind of relationship you're going to want post surrogacy, which again, you know, you raise all those questions.
Yeah, you can't contract for it either. I mean, you can't be like, you know, I want to be at Christmas, not Easter, but, you know, every second birthday party. Like there's nothing you could do to sort of formalize it in the way that a lump sum can. But it was really interesting because I spoke to Sarah Roberts, who's also a lawyer, a family lawyer, and negotiates a lot of these surrogacy contracts, and she was a surrogate and an egg donor. And what she said is she was more scared that the couple, the intended parents, would want her to keep the baby. And a lot of, like, some of, well, a lot, her surname, but also she also felt that, like, that a few of the surrogates, that she's going to be left with the baby, because they actually don't want the baby. If they wanted the baby, they would have another baby. So I found that, I mean, and it doesn't always play out like that. There are some horrible cases, which I go into as well, where surrogates want to keep the baby, but it's really interesting because you're talking to someone who thinks in a completely different way to the way you think.
Yeah, but even sperm donation. I mean, there was a program, I think it was on Netflix. I can't remember where I saw it, but I immediately perked up. Yeah, because I'd been reading the book. So I was like, oh, this is right on topic. Yes. And it was this movie with this guy, right, who was in, I think he was he'd come to Australia, right? He was in your book, I think, Matthew. He was in Australia to meet some of his many, many children. He was a sperm donor.
Oh, this is a different one. No, I haven't seen that one.
I'll find out what it was. But he was a donor, and he had no idea. I think you talk a little bit about this notion, and because there were others, he had no idea when he was donating as a, you know, a teenager to make some, you know, a young college student to make some money, that his sperm was being used so vastly, so wildly. And you do also do that profiles of people who, you know, who have knowingly dispersed their sperm.
Yeah, which is a different thing.
Which is a whole different thing, you know, with some kind of, I guess, the idea that, you know, I have lots of progeny, therefore that's that's some kind of masculinity thing. I don't know. But this guy
evolutionary.
Yeah, something like that. But this guy didn't know. But when he found out later just how many children he had fathered, he tried to get in touch with all of them and be there.
That's fantastic.
In some way. He was quite good about it. I think, you know, if you listen to his, what he said, anyway,
definitely
from his point of view. I'll source it out and find out, because I was watching it and he said, look, I don't condone what happened. I'm actually against this. I should have been told. And I signed and, something to say that I didn't want anybody to know who I was. But now I do feel I have a responsibility to at least introduce myself and say, I'm here if you have any questions or you want to know, anything about your origins. And I also am available, for birthday parties or, whatever it is.
Well, that's really lovely.
Yeah, but there
But
were a
I
lot.
do, and
I mean, there were like 100 kids.
yeah, and in America in particular, because they don't have the donor limits. I mean, they have a really strange law where it's sort of, you can create X amount of children in in this particular area, and then of course you can do it all across the country. But I guess what kind of is interesting in gamete donation is you want young gametes, right? Like you want a gamete is an egg or a sperm cell. And the best chances of success are to use an egg from a younger donor and an egg from, well, with sperm it matters less, but particularly with women, you want a younger egg donor. What happens in Australia is you can't pay egg donors, and you have a lot of altruistic women, and these are usually women who have had their own fertility struggles. And so, as a gesture, they donate their eggs, but the average age is usually above 30. So, you're not, they have a very good system of informed consent, but the quality of the product is, if we're looking at it that way, is not as good as something you're going to get from, someone in the US who's trying to pay off her college tuition, and then 10 years later might be like, oh shit, what have I done? So yeah, it's a very strange thing to kind of negotiate ethically and effectively in terms of conception.
Yeah, fascinating. Was there anything while you were doing your research that you were just like, oh my God, I had no, like that really changed the way you thought about something or that really shocked you?
Like lots. I mean, it's funny. I should really be more prepared for this question because there was just so much. I mean, I loved going back to the old newspaper articles, and that was a big favorite, like a favorite thing of mine, of just how shocked people were at everything. How, every little thing that's kind of, more or less normal today is, it was so confronting. And I remember particularly learning about donor insemination, and because in the UK, there were clinics who were just offering it. And this was before sperm could be frozen. So you'd have to kind of have someone nearby. The woman would be ovulating, you'd have to have some bloke nearby who'd be willing to kind of donate sperm, but he'd also have to kind of resemble the father. So it would be, it was kind of quite, it was quite hard to arrange. And the church, the Catholic Church in particular, they didn't like the spilled seed, the because, they thought that children, as much as they're not intersex, children should be conceived, with sex and sex alone. But I mean, there was one little thing I remember. It was a note from a Filipino, maybe, I don't, maybe he wasn't a Filipino priest, but it was a specific priest. And he kind of said, well, donor insemination is okay, but you've, as long as, the act of sex is happening, and then you save some of the seed, and then you can inseminate. But it's very specific. It's probably like a category on Pornhub. It's not, it's so just specific that a priest would actually think of that.
Perfect
But
instruction notes.
yeah,
Step one
exactly.
has to be, yes.
Yeah, and also, I guess, there's so much about the AIDS crisis that was really devastating. And this kind of goes back. So Ezra Klein and Dan Savage talked about that recently, in terms of gay marriage. I mean, all these families that are now, we've adapted as straight people, we're looking into polyamory and things like that. People in queer communities, they've been kind of changing, they've changed the norm because they weren't included in the norm. So, we're decades behind them. But during the AIDS crisis, the not having a next of kin as your partner, I mean, that's when gay marriage, as Dan Savage said, that really became important, because that person couldn't come visit you at hospital. They couldn't, they were kind of a no one, and your own family had abandoned you. So, and just, yeah, just the way that people were treated, that sat out, like it's really heartbreaking, a lot of the stuff. And really, Another interesting paper was, so I think homosexuality was illegal in various states until what, the 60s, 70s and 80s in Australia, I think in the 90s, even in Tasmania from memory. But with lesbians, they weren't included in that. And I was trying to kind of look at why. And there was just this amazing British parliamentary kind of paper where they were examining whether, you know, same sex amongst women should be criminalized as well. But they kind of thought, oh, if we put it in here, we're sort of advertising it. They wouldn't think of it otherwise. And, you know, so many women share a bed anyway. Like, you don't want them to get in trouble and report each other for that if they have a fight. But it was just so interesting that even the way sex was perceived as intercourse and, you know, anything outside of that was just not, you know, filler, not that relevant. I mean, that was interesting too.
Yeah, fascinating. I mean, fascinating perspective to look so closely at the historical trends and, you know, where we are now. And I guess things continue to change, like future tech. So, I mean, one of the, that whole sort of towards the end of the book where you get into eugenics is really, really fascinating to me. Even things like, you know, how you determine attractiveness and intelligence. And these are, you know, subtle things. Any parent can tell you, you know, there's no such thing as intelligence. It's a whole combination of factors, some of which are, you know, straight up the center line of what we consider intelligence, but a lot of things are on the sidelines. So what might make somebody intelligent is also what might make them, you know, or what we constitute as intelligence is a kind of intensity that may not be so normative, for example. So there's a whole range of different things that make up any one label that we might give to somebody. So when you start to select for those, you know, where do you end up with? I mean, even if you accept that it's okay, which it's not, but, you know, the whole notion of beauty or the whole notion of intelligence, yeah, these are movable trend related things.
Yeah, it's this kind of subjective. Yeah, and also the best interest of the child is really subjective. You would think that's kind of objective, but actually it's not at all. I mean, what I found really interesting with the way that people select from sperm banks is it would be quite different to the way they would select in real life as well. Like, I still probably don't know my husband's uncle's medical history, or, you know, whereas you have all that information from a sperm bank and that's what you're choosing. And I often wonder if you would meet the sperm donor, would it be different? I mean, and this is why a lot of people go to Facebook, because they do want to meet the person and see who they are. And I get it, because I think people on paper are very different to the way they are in real life. But also, what are you trying to do? I mean, and whether it, you know, it gives you a semblance of control over something you really don't have a huge amount of control of. And I think it gives you more control than you think you have, you know, that you think you have more control than you actually have.
Absolutely. So we're starting to run out of time, and but I want to ask you the question. You clearly have a knack for the longer form. I won't make Tammy Sussman's mistake of asking you when the next book is coming out. I wouldn't do that to you, but poor Tammy. But are there aspects of this or other topics that are just clawing at you that you'd really love to, you know, get your teeth into?
Yeah, there are a few. I mean, even with this, like, you know, I think some authors, they're done. They finish the book, like the book is done and they put it away and they know it's finished. Whereas I was done because it had been 3 years. I had pulled all-nighters, you know, I'm 40, like, not, it's not an age where you want to be pulling all-nighters. Like, you know, there were weeks where I did, you know, 2 or 3 days with zero sleep, just trying to get it in. So, you know, I was done.
And you did say, and I'm just
going
to interrupt here, you did mention really interesting in your interview with Tammy about how it's not just a single person's decision, right? There's a whole family that has to be part of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's funny because I would often think of, you know, male authors, like, I don't know how Philip Roth worked, but they don't have that kind of negotiation. I mean, maybe they do, but I imagine they just go off to a studio and bark at anyone who speaks to them during their writing hours. But look, it really upended our family. But no, and I do. So even with this, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily do a sequel, but there's so many, like, topics that I haven't touched, non-binary, you know, trans people. I would love to do more on multi-parent families. So, you know, There's that. And I do have a few topics in mind as well for other things, but you know, I sometimes take a deep breath and discuss them with my husband, but I sort of leave the room quite quickly after. But there's
I guess that's a downside because you now have opened a door for the law reform.
Yes.
And I guess it's kind of calling to you.
You're
going to get the question again. I'm sorry. That's just how it works.
No, I don't mind. I don't mind the question. Every time he's a good friend. So it was, I was teasing.
It's a natural question. I saw it and I was like, right, of course.
But I also don't want to say I have this idea and then I haven't really discussed it with anyone and it's a crappy idea as well. So you don't know.
And every author gets it. It's the worst question and the best, you know. You're constantly getting it. And then you think, well, if I answer it enough, maybe I'll get the idea for the next book. So you mentioned it, last question, you mentioned in the end that you really struggled to summarize your own attitude. So talk to me a little bit about that and how you came to resolve it as you did.
Well, you know what? It's, and I think I can see it now in a really interesting way, but we like having a victim and a perpetrator. And you know, I don't know if you've ever done couples therapy, but we have. And one of the things a therapist said to me was that when I was being a bit immature was that I have black and white thinking. And I found that really helpful when you have that, like, one side is wrong, therefore this side is right. So I gave up. And also, who cares what I think? I'm not, you know, I'm not affected by any of these decisions. But I did feel, so what you're alluding to is, I did feel like I was betraying a lot of the donor-conceived people who were distressed by the way they were created, because in other chapters I had celebrated people who really wanted kids for a long time and used those very same means to have children. So just putting those two things side by side, I felt almost two-faced. And this has really helped me with, you know, the stuff that's going on in the Middle East, is the idea that you can just hold these two truths at once. You don't have to judge. You can kind of, there's no limit to sort of empathy and sympathy, you know. But I was very stuck on it because I felt like I thought the mission of the book was to have an answer and a solution and something like that. And I'm not sure why I decided that I was the person to solve it, but you know, when I let go of that idea, it got a bit easier to stop.
Wonderful. Well, that's all we have time for today, but I will include all links to the book and your website and everything
thank
in
you.
The show notes. So thank you so much for joining me, Marina.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time and for reading the book. I really appreciate it.
Bye for now.
Bye.